Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. First of all, to start off with, after our summer break, we're back and looking forward to bringing you more shows with exciting guests. And I'm happy to start off our new series after the summer break with Charlie Winter. And he is on the show today to discuss his recent paper called The Virtual Caliphate, Understanding Islamic State's Propaganda Strategy. So first of all, welcome to the show, Charlie.
Thanks for having me on.
And for our listeners, Charlie Winter is a senior research and programs officer at the Quilliam Foundation, which is located in the United Kingdom. So we have him all the way over across the pond, so to speak, to be on the show today.
Brilliant. Thanks for having me on.
So Charlie, why don't we start off with you telling our listeners, how long did the span of this research take for this paper? And what were your methods?
So I decided pretty early on to have limitations for the extent of the research, because obviously dealing with Islamic State's propaganda machine, it's vast. It has a huge amount of video, photo and audio releases coming out every day. So I wanted to look at a delimited amount of time. So I took it from the beginning of the first year of the Islamic State Caliphate. So from the 29th of June 2014 onto the 29th of June 2015, and looked at essentially as much as I could within that time span. So I'm working on a different project at the moment where I'm actually logging every single piece of propaganda that's coming out. But over the last year, for this particular project, I was downloading as much as I could, but within the realm of being able to do other things at the same time. I think that it still enabled me to get a very good impression, a very accurate impression of what it is that Islamic State is trying to channel in its propaganda, what narratives it's trying to get out there and trying to spread both to its enemies and to its friends, both to its sympathizers and to those very disconnected audiences abroad in places like the States and the UK, the public. So in terms of what methods I used to try and gather together this information, how I could figure out what was real, legitimate Islamic State propaganda, what was official, what was unofficial, how I could look at it in aggregate and delineate different narratives and forms from within that. It's all about identifying, first of all, the dissemination process of the propaganda. So essentially, a lot of it's done through the use of hashtags. They use the hashtags like filtering mechanisms. So with the right combination of hashtags for a particular media foundation or for a particular provincial media outlet, you can pretty much certainly get everything that is coming out of that foundation or outlet at any one time. And it's done in a manner which means that the accounts can't really be censored. There is no one account which is releasing Islamic State's propaganda. It's pretty well democratized. So it means that it's very easy for it to continue being released, even in the face of censorship and mass suspensions that Twitter's been implementing more recently. But it's all about figuring out how these guys exist, how they interact with each other online, and how they use hashtags in order to insulate themselves from being caught out by social media corporations.
And you mentioned these hashtags. Is there an estimate you can give us about how many hashtags are out there that are affiliated with the Islamic State, ISIS, whatever you want to call it these days?
Well, I mean, there's a hashtag for every province. So, for example, if we take Anbar province, you have Walayat al-Anbar. It's very simple. That delineates that is Anbar Province's Islamic State news. And then from within that, there are other hashtags like Taqrir Busawar, which means photo report. So that delineates that if you have both of those present, that's a photo report coming from the Anbar Province. A similar case for videos. But all of these are also kind of given the hallmark of Dawlat al-Khilafa, the state of the caliphate. Which is another hashtag which is used to intercept or at least as a means of kind of protecting against other bots from that are trying to take over these hashtags. Because one thing that you do notice is that in the effort to counteract the efficiency with which Islamic State can spread its propaganda online, there are users or bots that are flooding the provincial hashtags and making them impossible to disseminate propaganda on. So what Islamic State has done is introduce another few hashtags that refine the search even more, make it even more precise. So while it's less accessible to the outside world and you have to go looking for it even more and know kind of what keys to use to find the right area, it does mean that it's a lot harder to censor as well, because they can just keep adding and changing the way that these things are hallmarked. And that means that it can constantly keep the output up, even if there are bots working against it or censorship, that kind of thing.
And for you as a researcher in this topic, it seems like ISIS has to adapt constantly with the challenges on social media, as you were saying, bots and so forth. How does that make your job more difficult or more easy potentially for your research?
Well, it certainly makes it more interesting. I'd say that given the amount of time I spend doing this, it's fairly easy to adapt with them. So to notice when a particular website's been taken down or a particular mode of disseminating has been obstructed, it's fairly easy to adapt with Islamic State's disseminators and see how they're shifting their techniques to go with it. And it makes it very interesting to see how they adapt and how quick they are to adapt. But also another thing that's enabled me to do is see fairly linear progressions of the evolution of Islamic State propaganda from pretty scruffy this time last year to something which is very well honed now. I mean, I think that's something which is fairly often missed, that when talking about Islamic State's propaganda machine, we assume that it's this monolithic entity and it's always been as effective as it has, but it really has developed a huge amount, even in the last 12 months, and it's continuing to do so now. I mean, just a couple of weeks ago, there's a complete overhaul of its iconography. So, all of the different provinces, the different wilayat, they were given new logos and it kind of looked a bit more corporate. It was interesting, but this kind of thing is happening all the time, where they're introducing new elements, seeing whether they work, because of course, social media analysis enables the propagandists themselves and the disseminators to really figure out whether something has gone down well in the community of supporters or not. So they're constantly trying new things, and it does make it a formidable enemy when it comes to putting together counter narratives. But I guess we'll talk about that a little later on.
From what you've just said about their adaptation with different methods of propaganda, it almost seems like they're using typical marketing schemes of, okay, if something doesn't work, we try something new, try it out in the public, see if it works. I mean, is that something that you're picking up in your research?
Yeah, I think that definitely is something that's happening. I think that when we look to governments or civil society bodies to present counter narratives, we always are kind of shocked at the ineffectivity of it. But I think that one thing which makes us structurally impaired from being able to match Islamic State's ability to do this is the fact that there is a lot more bureaucracy and red tape that we need to get through, especially if it's at a government level. Islamic State, while it does have a very centralized propaganda structure, while it does have a very definite set of media offices and media foundations and propagandists, and a very definite means of dissemination, it's a lot more fluid. And I think that the ability to adapt and shift its strategy in the face of the international challenges that are increasingly being present, I think that is something which really does strengthen its ability, strengthen its relevance, and strengthen its appeal as an organization, the fact that it's constantly changing. And you hit the nail on the head when you said that it's as if it's marketing. I think that that's exactly what is happening here. It's not just marketing using different narratives and trying to sell the caliphate idea itself, but it's using marketing techniques to try and maximize its viewership, maximize the ultimate reach that it has across the world.
Why don't you provide us with the common types of propaganda we're seeing being used by the Islamic State? what are the common elements that we see on social media, print, etc.?
So if we look at photo reports first, these are the most ubiquitous kind of propaganda that Islamic State releases. They more recently have been refined into formal photo reports that have their own kind of poster put together and are circulated alongside this poster. But then also photos which are released with the hashtag Ajil, so hashtag urgent or breaking. These are photographs of developing situations. Essentially, they show things like battlefield reporting or parades throughout the many provinces of the caliphate, so showing off the arms and soldiers of the Islamic State. But then we also have things which appear a lot more inane, but are just as important, if you ask me. Things like honey production, photo reports of swimming pools, of kids swimming in the Euphrates River, really things which probably seem quite benign individually, and are by all accounts. But the message that they're sending is that life is operating as normal. There may be a coalition attacking Islamic State from all sides, but we're managing to create the Islamist utopia that we promised that we would create. So that's just a brief look at photo reports. Obviously, we have also the daily bulletins, the Idha'at Tabayan, which is released in, I think it's now six languages, so English, Russian, French, Kurdish, Arabic, and there is one more which has slipped my mind. This is essentially a news bulletin which is predominantly focused on the military advances and military developments of Islamic State in the various provinces all over the caliphate as it views itself. It's released in PDF format every day, again in multiple languages, but also as a radio broadcast. And this is something which is broadcast within the boundaries of the caliphate, at least in Iraq and Syria as well. I believe that the kind of center of the radio station is in Nineveh province in Mosul. There's a video that was depicting its activities that was released a couple of weeks ago. So that's the audio side of things and the photo side of things. Probably the most famous part of its propaganda, simply because it's the most prominent and accessible, is video propaganda. I'm giving a very brief idea of what these things are. I mean, the variation of narrative is profound in terms of looking at these things, but just briefly for the structure of video propaganda, they tend to be quite short, but they can vary from between, well, just one that was released by the Egyptian Sinai province a couple of minutes ago, that's 1 minute, 18 seconds. But they can go for well over an hour as well. So there's a lot of variation in terms of time. Often that dependent on what the content is. So if it's an out-and-out execution of a group of alleged spies, then that usually only goes for 8 minutes or so, because there's not actually that much that you can show for that. But if there's more of a narrative, it's something, for example, a video showing the revitalization of the hospital system in Raqqa, that can go on for a bit more, because they can interview multiple characters, they can talk about this fantastic technology and the expertise of the doctors of Islamic State, etc., etc., etc. And whether that's true or not, whether they are fantastic doctors, whether they do have fantastic technology, it's kind of arbitrary. If you're watching these videos as a supporter of Islamic State, then you're going to see what you want to see. And I think that that's something which is quite an important thing to get. A lot of people consuming Islamic State propaganda, they're doing so actively. They're not just absorbing it, but they are getting what they want from it. So the last kind is written propaganda. So this can be anything from individual statements to magazines. I mean, the most famous magazine is, of course, Darbuk, but they have Dar al-Islam, which is a French language magazine, a Russian magazine, a Turkish magazine. All of these have fairly repetitive content. I wouldn't say that they're particularly accessible to new recruits or simply people who sympathize with the idea of Islamic State. I mean, they're pretty dense in terms of the theological content that they have, but again, they're very effective. They show that well, they're very effective in ways. They show that Islamic State is a professional, well-organized and very considered in its propaganda making, something which really demonstrates that it's really carefully thinking about what the image it wants to portray is, and really grounding as much as it can in theology, in the idea that it is enacting this pristine Islam that's been lost in the last 1,000+ years, and that it is really bringing about a renaissance of Islam. And of course, that's not true. But if you are a sympathizer, if you're a supporter who wants to think it's true, then but in aggregate, all of this stuff does tell a very strong message.
What about the more uncommon types of propaganda that we see? What are they?
So we have a situation where they release content on a daily basis. Then you have the central outlets, which are a lot rarer in the videos that they release. So here I'm talking about Mu'assasat al-Furqan, Mu'assasat al-I'tisam, and the Al-Hayat Media Center. So if we look at each of these in isolation of each other, they make distinct propaganda. So the Furqan Foundation, Mu'assasat al-Furqan, that is something which is probably the most notorious in terms of the videos that it's produced, because it's the one which has been responsible for many of the beheadings. The international journalists who were beheaded last year by Jihadi John, as the media tended to enjoy calling him, but also some of the feature-length kind of orgies of brutality that Islamic State produces. So there was on the prophetic methodology, which was a particularly brutal release, but also Salila Sawarin, the claim of the swords, which is a fairly idiosyncratic name, but again, it's something which has a very strong, very brutal set of content in it. So Furqan has not released anything for a little while. Its last release was at the beginning of Ramadan. It was something that was looking specifically at zakat distribution in Ramadi, but it's been quiet. And I think that's probably going to change sooner or later, because it's also the foundation which delivers audio messages from Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and Abu Muhammad al-Adnani, respectively the caliph and spokesman of Islamic State. So the next foundation, Mu'assasat al-I'tisam, this produces, again, it's been around for a long time, but it hasn't produced quite so much over the last year. But it tends to really focus on battlefield reporting. So, for example, there's a recent video that really showed start to finish a lot of the fighting in Beji, or around Beji, very kind of well put together, well edited, and well considered video of the Islamic State's offensive there. But again, it's been fairly quiet of late, and whether that's indicative of the fact that it's merged with other organizations, as we've seen provincial media outlets kind of increase in their ability to produce professional looking high definition propaganda. That's perhaps what's happening there. Then the last one that I mentioned earlier, the Al-Hayat Media Center. This produces magazines like Dabiq. It produces the foreign language content for Islamic State. It's also responsible for the mass beheading video from Libya back in February, I believe it was, on the beach just outside Sirte, which was particularly interesting. I mean, it was, of course, abhorrent, but in terms of the structural side of it and the practicalities of it, it seem to suggest that perhaps someone or some people from Al-Hayat Media Center actually went from Syria, Iraq, where they have been based, to Libya to film the video, because it was very, very well produced. I mean, I have to stress that whoever's producing the highest level videos, because there is some fodder, there is some stuff which is really poor. But for the highest levels of Islamic State propaganda, the most sophisticated and carefully choreographed videos, these guys clearly know what they're doing. They're using rails and they're using equipment which you can't really just teach yourself. And there is a level of, I mean, professionalism is a buzzword which I think has been overused by the media. But certainly in some respects, Islamic State's propaganda operation is very professional.
So another question is, in the intro to the virtual caliphate, there's a statement that says the Islamic State has revolutionized the jihadist messaging. How have they done this? What have you seen in your research that revolutionizes the messages?
So I think that one important thing that Islamic State has brought to jihadist messaging, and it's important to emphasize first off actually that other groups like Al-Qaeda, be it Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula or Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria, they do produce propaganda, and they have done for a very long time, and it has been professional looking a lot of the time as well. But Islamic State have taken their media strategy in a different direction. They've really put their all into creating a very large media presence that's very easy to access and very vocal and noticeable, not just to other jihadists and supporters, but to the international community at large. So I think that that's been a very deliberate approach to try and assist Islamic State in its attempts to knock Al-Qaeda off the pedestal as the kind of bête noire of international jihadism. And I think it's something that to be quite frank, it probably did do fairly successfully. But at the same time, I think that Al-Qaeda has kind of welcomed that because it has been seen in many ways as the more moderate option to Islamic State, simply because it doesn't publicize its brutalities in the same way that IS does. So in terms of dissemination, it's revolutionized that in the sense that it doesn't use centralized accounts. It has some official disseminators, but these are individuals who are regularly suspended and then pop back up, and they have their own means to demonstrate that they are who they say they are. And then there is this larger network of individuals who are very, very active on Twitter at all times. And I'd say that the majority of this does happen on Twitter, who are very active on Twitter at all times, and they are always looking out for the latest release of propaganda, be it a video, be it a set of photos, be it the daily bulletin. And they work very hard to constantly disseminate and constantly replenish the body of existing propaganda that's out there. Because I think that one of the key uses for propaganda in Islamic State's case is it's used as an evidence base for recruiters. So it gives individuals who are talking about the joys of living in Islamic State, the joys of living in the caliphate, it gives them something to show off to the people that they're trying to win over. So that's where photos like swimming pools and bakeries and markets, and there's been a recent series on the flourishing economies of various regions of Islamic State held Syria. That's where they really, really come in and are important. In terms of the content itself, I think that the way in which Islamic State has revolutionized jihadist propaganda, jihadist messaging, is to a large extent in the volume of the output it has. I mean, the product that I'm working on at the moment, I'm taking 1 month of Islamic State's a 1 month snapshot of Islamic State's propaganda. So this is involving going through all of the provincial outlets on a daily basis, spending a couple of hours going through them and collecting everything that was released the previous 24 hours. And it's a very rigorous task, but I think it's worth doing because even though I spend all my time doing this, I'm surprised by the amount of content that's coming out. It's been 2 weeks and there's already well over 600 different propaganda campaigns, and the variation within them is very, very significant. And they're not just one photo here or there, they're photo sets, they're videos. And you can really tell that this is an operation which has been very carefully delegated, because there is uniformity, there is consistency in the message, and there is a constant effort to keep this set of ideas alive. So I think that when I talk about the fact that Islamic State has revolutionized what it's doing, or how a jihadist group messages, it does so by changing the way it disseminates, by really giving its supporters as much of a role as they can without even having to leave their bedrooms or their computers. It really does channel the idea that if you can sit at home and translate propaganda and then spread it to your circle of friends, circle of followers, like-minded followers, that is, then that's really contributing to the Islamic State jihad too. And the second way that it's revolutionized it is in terms of volume, the sheer weight and breadth of Islamic State propaganda is vast. And I think that that's something that's very, very important because it enables it to really keep up appearances and show that this is something which isn't going away and it's something which is constantly developing and something which is constantly fulfilling the promises that its leaders are giving in their sporadic audio messages. I think that that's very, very important for it to sustain its global campaign to attract people.
Personally, I think one thing that makes propaganda of any type important and something that will stick with you is portraying a story. And I find that the Islamic State in their propaganda is very good at doing this. I was wondering if we could talk about this a bit.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, whether it's telling a story in snapshots with various photo reports or a series of short videos showing the same thing happening in various parts of the caliphate, as it likes to think of itself, or whether it's a longer video where it shows a narrative of an individual who's been accused of being a spy, first of all being captured by Islamic State security forces, then being interrogated and coming out with what it is that he's done, who it was that he's working for, but also how he got to that position, and then ultimately the final sequence where they are invariably executed. That's a very effective and brief, easily told story. And I think it's, for some people, exactly what they want to see. For the Islamic State ideologue, they want to see these people being killed. They want them to be humiliated and humiliate their enemies and seek to intimidate potential dissenters or people considering working against Islamic State. And I think that does gratify a certain base of support for Islamic State. In terms of other stories which aren't brutal, and I think that these ones are probably more important because there's a tendency to focus on the videos where people are being drowned in a cage or burned alive in a car or beheaded with explosives, that kind of thing. While it is important to recognize that these horrendous, horrendous crimes are being committed by Islamic State, there is another side to their propaganda which is very much focused on the utopia. And I really think that this utopian element of Islamic State's narrative is probably the thing which attracts most people to it. There was a time where people would go to Syria to fight Assad more than anything. But I think that more recently we've seen people going to Islamic State, at least in Syria, because it is calling itself Islamic State and a lot of its propaganda is really showing that if you are that way inclined, if you think that the jihadist interpretation of Islamism, the jihadist interpretation of Islam is the correct thing and you want to live in a situation of pristine Islam as Islamic State sells it, then that's a very powerful story. So here we have a great many feature-length videos which look at things which are quite stale to someone who is not particularly interested in this kind of thing. So looking specifically at how children are taught in schools, what they're being taught, going from schools to training centers, seeing what kind of jihadist literature they're looking at, going from training centers to hospitals, to medical centers, to dentists, to really look at the breadth of how society and economy is still operating, even in light of the coalition's attacks on Islamic State. It's always looking to assert its continuity and assert the fact that it does have a normal civilian population which is not only supportive of the state's political aims and its religious aims, but also operating as normal, that it has people working, it has social services, all that kind of thing. And I mean, let me stress here that I really don't take what Islamic State is saying through these videos and photos at face value, I think that it's really, really important that we don't do that, because if we use Islamic State's propaganda as our main source of information on it, then we're really putting ourselves in a tricky situation. I think all of this material needs to be taken with a very hefty pinch of salt, and it must always be kept in mind that Islamic State, in whatever it does, has an agenda. So when it is releasing a video of someone being killed in an awful way, that is to distract from something else, or it's to really shape the discourse on how people are talking about Islamic State. When it's releasing videos showing hospitals or schools, I don't think anyone would believe that hospitals are actually operating absolutely as normal in the boundaries of Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. But also, I think there's, if we look even closer at that, at where these videos are coming out from, what hospitals they're looking at, there's a lot to be told from which parts of the caliphate are more secure, which are operating better than others. And I think that this is something that my current project, which is logging everything that is released over the course of a month, that'll enable me to really see which provinces, which provincial media offices are producing what. And I think that that'll be interesting to see how that reflects what's happening on the ground in terms of the anti-Islamic State offensive.
Those are very valid points you just mentioned. In the virtual caliphate, you lay out six key narratives, and those are brutality, mercy, victimhood, war, belonging, and utopia, which you've touched upon already. Could we look at these other narratives that are keys that they use in their propaganda in more detail?
Yes, absolutely. After, all of the ones which I'm about to talk about, they all kind of bottleneck into the utopian idea of Islamic State. They all have an element of them which can be understood as supporting the overall utopian idea, the idea that Islamic State is on the offensive, the idea that it is welcoming to all who want to join it, the idea that it is a place where pristine Islam is being practiced. These are all things which do lend, or Islamic State hopes lend credence to the idea that it is a utopia. So if we look specifically at the first one I identify, which is brutality, this is the kind of video where you see groups of alleged spies being killed en masse, or individuals being shot in the back of the head by children. Not necessarily, I'd say, amputations and stonings. I think that while they are kind of integrated into the brutality narrative, I'd say that they're more to do with showing that Islamic State is really implementing hudud punishments, implementing Sharia law. And I think that goes more into utopia than it does brutality, even though they are, of course, very violent acts. What brutality does is it speaks to a variety of different audiences. It speaks to the Islamic State ideologue that I was speaking about earlier. It gratifies them to see their co-believers, their like-minded comrades, killing their enemies in horrendous ways and humiliating them and really emphasizing their supremacy. But also to sympathizers, I think that it shows this level of defiance and makes Islamic State look like this organization which is not going to balk in the face of the international coalition against it. To its enemies, brutality sends a very strong message too. It shows to observers that the justice that Islamic State meets out is very, very brutal and very swift and unwavering. And I think that it's trying to send a message of intimidation as much as it is the next message, which I think is provocation. We know that, going back to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who was the kind of ideological forefather for what we have today in Islamic State, we know that the idea of provocation was very central to how he operated. The idea of really provoking sectarian tensions, thrusting the region into more chaos, as much chaos as possible, so then you can galvanize support on both sides and really usher on this polarization of communities and ultimately strengthen the cause. I think that that's very, very important. And I think it's something which is fairly often missed or less so now, but I think that it's a very important element of Islamic State's brutality propaganda that when you do see someone being killed in an awful manner, it is very much aware, its propagandists are very much aware of the reaction that they're going to get from the international community, be it from governments or publics. And that's briefly to touch upon the last thing that brutality channels is an international reaction. It really gets notoriety for Islamic State. It secures it a place, a weekly place in the newspapers. It really makes sure that they get to be at the front of news hours and really helps it keep its relevance up. And I think that's very important for a terrorist organization. The next narrative is mercy. So here, these are things that are a little rarer than the idea of brutality, but mercy at the hands of both Islamic State and also the religion is a very important theme. It's the idea that anyone, regardless of whether they are the enemies of Islamic State in terms of being soldiers fighting in the Syrian Arab Army or in Jabhat al-Nusra or that's Syrian al-Qaeda's Syrian affiliate or even the Iraqi security forces. It's the idea that clemency will be granted if it is requested. And this is to always show that Islamic State will welcome people into its arms, and it will really try to assimilate into its cause if they are willing to do so. So this is obviously important in terms of ensuring constant replenishing of manpower and that kind of thing. But also it gives them an ability to say, look, we offered you clemency and you didn't take it. But it's a very kind of winner's messaging kind of thing. David Gartenstein Ross said a very kind of apt thing about Islamic State's propaganda that it is very much focusing a lot of the time on the idea of supremacy, the idea that it is winning in this war. And there's nothing like a video showing a mass conversion, if you like, of enemies to the Islamic State cause to show that, or at least attempt to show that Islamic State is winning in the war.
On
The
that point, do we know if these videos that show so-called Islamic State enemies repenting, do we know if they're actually legit in the sense of once they show them repenting and forgiving them their sins and welcoming to the them to the Islamic State, is that something we can really believe? Do we have any evidence backing that up, that people are joining the ranks and basically staying alive and not being killed after the filming is done?
That's a really interesting question. I think that it's something that Islamic State propagandists don't really preoccupy themselves with doing. They like to say, look, this has happened, and then move on. But there are instances where you do see people who have pledged allegiance to Islamic State and then they pop up a bit later on because they've been killed or killed in battle, and they kind of pop up because there's a eulogy among Islamic State supporters about their lives. But I think that's a really good point, that you do regularly see these mass repentances, these mass responses to Islamic State's calls for repentance. But there isn't so much of an aftershot of what's happening there. But I think that for as many of these videos that we see, of course there are going to be people who are just going through the motions, and you can really see that if they have a video of 500 or 600 people in a room, and you look at people in the room. I mean, obviously there are some who are looking more fervent than others, and I think that it's important to recognize that people are joining the group because they're being coerced to. And I mean, this is all part of the whole thing that Islamic State supporters and fighters and members, they aren't a monolithic group. There are people who have been coerced into it. People who really believe in the ideology, people who don't believe in the ideology but believe in the political program. I mean, there are a lot of things which make Islamic State supporters vary, and I think it's really important that we recognize that they aren't just one group. That in the future, if there is a little more success in terms of pushing Islamic State back, that kind of thing will be very important to recognize that they can't all be treated in the same way, and that there have to be different messages targeting different groups. Because if we write off everyone at the same time, then that will make life a lot more difficult in the long run, I think. So I'll just carry on with the narratives. The next one that I identified was victimization, and we've seen a disproportionate amount of this in the last 2 weeks, I'd say. So since the end of Ramadan, obviously there are many things that victimization brings to a jihadist group's messaging. It gives it justification to do things. It gives it an ability to say, look, we're being attacked and we're fighting back. We're defiant. We're protecting Sunni Muslims. And it's really nothing new in terms of its use by jihadist groups. But again, I'd say that the volume with which Islamic State uses it and the way that it juxtaposes it with brutality and things like that, I think it really does use it very expertly in terms of making sure that the consumers, the propagandees, as I call them in my report, are getting the right message. And we have seen a huge amount of very horrible footage and photographs emerging from Iraq and Syria, particularly in Aleppo province and Fallujah province recently, where children and, well, not women actually, children are photographed with very serious injuries or just plain dead. And this is as a result of, we're told, a result of the coalition's efforts against Islamic State, and it's to try and lend it legitimacy. I mean, this content is very, very difficult to look at. I mean, it's very powerful in what it says, but it's also very effective in legitimizing the program of what Islamic State is doing. But I think that the children, dead old people, they are very much instrumentalized by the propagandists. And this is something which is really emerging as a very powerful narrative that is very much the preoccupation of the people disseminating this material, because it does really fit very well into the overall narrative of this is the Sunni Muslim caliphate. It's being attacked by the Crusaders, it's being attacked by the Shiites, it's being attacked by the Zionists, and this is all evidence of these attacks, but we're pushing back, we're seeking to protect. That's how it fits into the narrative.
And that was the same narrative we saw with the starting of the revolution in Syria and, you know, all the YouTube videos of, we'll call it victimhood as you use that term, of children and civilians being killed by the Assad regime. So it's very interesting that, you know, that I guess that's a tried and true use of propaganda that the Islamic State is latching onto because it works.
Absolutely. And I'd say that Islamic State has taken it a little further in the way that it does juxtapose these kind of victim narratives with brutality. So a video that I referred to earlier, a very brutal one from Nineveh province in Iraq, in which three sets of spies were executed in really awful ways in three groups. That video began with the cameraman zooming in on a disembodied hand. And I believe that it was, I didn't look too closely, but I believe that it was the hand of a child. And it was picked up by the cameraman, who said that this was an area that had been bombed by the coalition. Here are some spies. They directed the planes to this area. So here's what we're going to do to them. And that is a way that Islamic State can justify the horrendousness of its acts. Of course, it's not justifiable. But if you are, again, if you are a supporter and you're getting from this propaganda what you want, then you can see that as a means of justification. An eye for an eye is something which is very regularly used by Islamic State as a way of legitimizing itself and kind of rejecting criticism that it's too brutal or too violent. So the last narrative, we've gone through brutality, mercy, victimhood and war, and also utopia. the last narrative, and I think this one's particularly important in terms of the effect it has on the foreign fighter population, the foreign fighter contingent of Islamic State, is the idea of belonging. So one thing that is commonly held, I mean, there's no generalization, there's no stereotyping in terrorism studies, but one thing which we do often see, or relatively often see, with foreign fighters from the West is that they are looking for something to be part of. They want to belong to a group. They want to belong to a cause. So Islamic State not only offers the cause, it offers the ability to be a founding father or founding mother of a new state, but it also offers the ability to really get a new bunch of friends. And we do see a lot of propaganda which is showing foreign fighters hanging out together in groups in parks in Raqqa, or drinking tea and singing nasheeds on a hillside in Aleppo province. This kind of thing is, I mean, it's very effective in the way that it manages to show the idea that you arrive in Islamic State and you immediately become part of the gang. I think the group mentality, the idea of being able to integrate yourself into the Islamic State collective, is a very powerful narrative and something that does really appeal to someone who perhaps feels very marginalized, dislocated from their home society, is looking for a way to be with like-minded individuals, a way to leave their sense of marginalization and isolation behind. And I mean, who's going to know radicalization better than Islamic State? They really know what works and what doesn't work. So I think that that's a very important, very striking feature of Islamic State propaganda that we tend to see more in video form than anything else. And of course, it's perpetuated by Islamic State's disseminators and its kind of proselytizer community online. But in terms of official propaganda, it tends to be, it tends to be videos released by the likes of Al Hayat Media Center. And that's indicative of the fact that it's looking outward. It's looking to direct its messaging at a foreign audience. These videos that come out in English and German and French, and I mean, recently in the Uyghur language, and also there's a recent message to Muslims in Turkestan, which was looking to emphasize the fact that you can come and be part of this great project. You can really integrate yourself into the Muhajirin, Muhajira, the migrant community of Islamic State citizens living in Raqqa, but not exclusively in Raqqa. But I think it's the idea of immediate assimilation, immediate integration, and overwhelming friendship and camaraderie that these videos really perpetuate. I think that does appeal a lot to the dislocated and the marginalized in the West.
And going back to the key narrative of utopia, which we talked about earlier, I know Will McCants has done a lot of work and is still doing a lot of work on the idea of an apocalyptic utopianism. And I was wondering, how does this also play into the Islamic State's propaganda? Because this is sort of a greater idea of utopia that they really, really utilize in their messaging.
Yeah, well, I'm very much looking forward to Will McCants' book on
this. Me too, me too.
from my reading of it, the message that Islamic State is trying to get out is one of urgency, that the utopia has been established, the caliphate has been established, having been decimated for a very long time. It has now been reinstated with a caliph, a rightful caliph, at its head. It is reinstating Sharia law, it's re-implementing Hadood punishments, it is calling Muslims from the world over to join it, to flock to it. And behind all of this is the sense that the coalition, which is invariably viewed by Islamic State as a crusader coalition, that the final battle has already begun, that the Yawm al-Qiyamah, the judgment day, is just around the corner, and that this is something which is being engaged in as we're speaking. So that's something which lends the Islamic State cause urgency. I mean, I view it to a large extent as a way of just keeping people interested and keeping people coming to join the group by really channeling the idea that we're seeing this final battle now, and you can not only come and be a founding member of the caliphate in its nascent year, or nascent years rather, but you can also join the battle before it's too late. You can secure yourself a place in Jannah, in paradise, before it's too late. And I think that to some that's a very powerful idea. But I mean, my reading of it is that it lends the cause urgency. It's been something which has been around in jihadist messaging and jihadist politicking for a long time. I mean, AQAP's media establishment is called Al-Malahim Media. So Malahim is referring to the final battles, plural of Malhama, which is the final battle. So I think that it's something which isn't unique necessarily to Islamic State as an idea, but certainly the amount that it comes up in the speeches of Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, for example, that is new. And the way that is instrumentalized is very important.
I would like to take the conversation now towards the outsourcing and dissemination of propaganda by ISIS, Islamic State. How do they outsource their propaganda and disseminate it and insulate themselves from government-led schemes to censor it? And who are the disseminators that we're looking at?
So, to take the first question there, that the way it has outsourced its propaganda is by really encouraging other individuals to get involved. This is something which can be done through putting together video montages or photo montages, putting together kind of fanboy posters, that kind of thing, but also by disseminating the message. So, not just showing the videos and the photographs and the audio bulletins, but actually literally just copying and pasting the message of what has been approved by Islamic State as the way that a given situation is being reported. So you do see a lot of tweets that just get repeated word for word in Arabic that are talking about a specific situation in Anbar province or Salah ad-Din province, that kind of thing. But in terms of the actual outsourcing of production, I think that this is something which is again made possible by the fact that Islamic State produces a huge amount of propaganda. So there's a lot of resources available, a lot of raw material available to rearrange and to fit back together. And one of the things that you very often see is Islamic State propaganda weaved into news reports from either Arabic media or Western media. Which is kind of juxtaposing the West's narrative with that of Islamic States. And while these videos don't have the same influence in terms of the amount that they're viewed, the sheer kind of regularity with which they're generated and regularity with which they're disseminated, it does keep the Islamic State online echo chamber alive, and I think that's very important. But it's not always the case that these videos aren't well watched. I mean, there's an individual who's a kind of outsourcing propagandist for Islamic State called Tarjuman al-Aswarti, and he is on his 213th Twitter account. He has a huge following and repeatedly comes back, regardless of the fact that Twitter has suspended his account so many times. And he is someone who disseminates very well-produced montages, video montages of what I was just speaking about. And these videos do get very well watched. And I mean, there's very little that we can actually know about him because his account looks fairly ubiquitous, though it is hallmarked to show that it's him. But he's certainly someone who is encouraged, I'd say actively, but perhaps it is just tacitly by the Islamic State propagandists themselves to really carry on disseminating the message. In terms of the dissemination of propaganda itself, I mean, this is something which is really interesting to view in its earlier stages. So when there's a very prominent video release coming out or a very prominent statement coming out, there's always a forewarning of usually at least 6 or 7 hours where you'll have an individual who is definitely in the know. He'll say, coming soon, so he'll tweet in Arabic, coming soon, new release from Muassasat al-Furqan, for example, and then say whether it's Sauti or Mar'i, so video or audio. And then there is a lot of excitement in the Islamic State community about what this video is going to be. There's really a huge amount of tweeting about the new video. And then there's another development a couple of hours down the line is a poster is added, perhaps a few more details about who's going to feature in the video or audio release. And it really galvanizes excitement in the community. And of course, this will feed into the English-speaking community of Islamic State supporters too, who will begin to tweet about it and make a buzz about it too. And that's the buzz side of things, the excitement that the disseminator network of Islamic State has. I think that's really, really important, and also indicative of the fact that often this is very much a grassroots thing. It's not necessarily the case that the thousands of Twitter accounts that support Islamic State, that they are operating in tandem with each other. Of course, there is a very tight, very centralized structure at the top and at the heart of this whole determination process. But a lot of it is just let to go its own course because of the way that Islamic State supporters really crave these new propaganda videos, these new very significant statements. And they really do talk it up, and they get a lot of excitement going, which invariably gets a lot of people waiting on tenterhooks. And quite often it's kind of funny, you see Islamic State supporters tweeting pictures of or renderings of skeletons covered in cobwebs sitting by computers and complaining about how the fact that the video hasn't been released tonight means that they need to go to bed because they're too tired and they've been waiting for too long. I mean, there's a lot of this kind of thing, and it's very curious to see, but it's all about hyping up the Islamic State propaganda machine and really trying to channel as much excitement as possible. And this is something that kind of works into the symbiotic relationship that the propagandist has with the propagandee. The propagandist creates the videos, creates the photographs, and replenishes the product on a daily basis. And for that, the propagandee is reliant on them. They come to receive gratification and satisfaction from consuming this stuff. But then they also begin to disseminate it as well, and that takes them a little further into the game, if you like. They become more involved. Their agency in disseminating propaganda is undeniable now, and they are part of the dissemination process. So they become necessary for the propagandist, but they also end up disseminating and consuming for their own self-gratification. And I think that's something which is very carefully cultivated by Islamic State. And I mean, it's something which could have arisen organically, but it's a very sophisticated approach to outsourcing your dissemination methods.
And so the propagandee, or as you called them earlier, the fanboy, and should I also say we have fangirls out there, you know, they're constantly tweeting, retweeting Islamic State supportive tweets or posts on Facebook. But can some of the material that they put out themselves, so these fanboy fangirls, can it actually hurt the messaging of the official, I'm putting official in quotations, but the official Islamic State group?
Yeah, I think that can definitely be the case, but it's more often than not the case. I think that you do have these kind of fans of Islamic State talking about issues which sometimes they just don't know about, or they are very naive. They they aren't very well acquainted with Islam, for example, and then they end up getting into a conversation about a theological matter with someone from, and I've seen this happen with someone from Jabhat al-Nusra, who will really pick them apart and show that they know nothing about this particular element, and that they thought that they did, but they were just showing off and they're full of hubris, etc., etc. So in that sense, when the lack of knowledge is made visible by someone picking it apart, and I mean it tends to be other jihadists who are most effective at doing this, then that is a liability. But I think that in the main, usually the Islamic State disseminated community, it is quite inward looking, so it will criticize others, of course, but it doesn't, I mean, it deals fairly well with criticism from outside. But also, if you are sticking to perpetuating the idea of the Islamic State successes in terms of what they're doing politically, socially, and economically, then you can get quite far in terms of notoriety within the disseminator community without actually having to deal with anything, without having to come up with your own content, essentially. I mean, it's very interesting to just try as an experiment, kind of entering the kind of Islamic State echo chamber and starting to follow the right people and retweet the right stuff. You'll see that very quickly you do get absorbed into the collective, and that's without directly interacting with them. So I think that it's a necessary evil to have these kind of no barriers to entry, not even low barriers to entry, there are no barriers to entry for the people to engage with Islamic State propaganda and disseminate it and talk about it. And I think that while it is a liability in some senses, it does mean that you get a lot more people than you would otherwise. And I think that for Islamic State's propaganda strategy to work, it needs to have the constant attention of a lot of people.
Looking at the bigger picture of social media and the use of social media by jihadist organizations, in today's day and age, in your mind, has social media replaced what has been termed as like radical mosques or radical bookstores? What are your thoughts on this?
So, yeah, I think that it has become very important in terms of being an arena where people can exchange ideas, exchange battlefield stories, exchange practical advice, meet other like-minded individuals. And these were things that were done predominantly in so-called radical mosques and bookstores back in the 90s and earlier, of course, going into the 2000s too. I think that then we saw a migration of that kind of activity more towards forums, where password-protected places where you could, again, exchange ideas and practical advice, meet other people. But I do think now that a lot of this is happening on social media, a lot more is happening on social media than or at least in Islamic State's case, on social media than it is on forums. And I think that while social media is very important as a meeting place and a place to exchange ideas, so in that sense, it has replaced the radical mosque or radical bookstore. It's not the be-all and end-all of the radicalization process. I still am an ardent believer of the fact that radicalization happens because of an external influence. And I don't think that you would necessarily find it too easy to go onto the internet, start locating Islamic State propaganda and thereby identify the disseminator crowd or the proselytizer crowd, and then immediately be absorbed by them and end up being recruited to the organization. I think that while that has happened in some instances, I don't think it's quite that easy. I think there does need to be an external influence. And that's why we have quite often seen groups of friends being recruited to Islamic State at the same time, or I mean, for example, the three Bethnal Green girls who went out back in December, or maybe it was a little later than that actually, but they were following another school friend who had gone before them. That it really does help to have a friend who is in the know, who's taken the leap, and then can constantly try and push the line and really attract people to come and join them wherever they are. So in that sense, I think that the offline arena is still very, very important. But in terms of disseminating ideas, videos, pictures, stories, practical advice, I do think that social media is very important, and probably more important than it's ever been, because people can do that anonymously. They can create a fake name, they can use a fake picture, they can add fake friends, and there's not much that we can do about that. But they can, in so doing, render a lot of material which is very dangerous and very damaging available for themselves without too much effort.
To bring the talk to conclusion, I want to ask you more of a big question. So when considering ISIS's propaganda and everything you've looked at in your research, how can we view their propaganda and use it as a way of creating an effective counter-narrative, which is the big question out there, of course. We've seen so many young people join ISIS and go to Syria, as you were mentioning, the young girls, you know, all around the world. It's not just UK, it's not just in the Middle East. This is spanning many country borders. So by looking at their propaganda, personally, in your opinion, do you find ways of creating a counter-narrative that will actually last and potentially work?
Well, I think that we really should take a leaf out of Islamic State's book in the way that we approach this question. I think that there is no single counter-narrative that we can rely upon. And if we persist in trying to find it, we are going to persist in a fool's errand. I think that it's impossible to find a catch-all narrative that will solve the foreign fighter problem, that will destabilize Islamic State from within, that will cut through its utopian narrative, that will dissuade people from supporting it, its revolutionary agenda. I mean, there's simply no one narrative that will work. And rather like Islamic State does, it has various narratives, it uses them in different ways and targets them at different audiences. I think if we start thinking in those terms, then that could make our approach a lot more effective. One video which my think tank, Quilliam, had a pretty big role in the production of, has recently been released. It's called, or it's being circulated on the internet, the hashtag Not Another Brother, and it's essentially targeted at the hard end, so targeted at people who are thinking about going, and their companions, their friends, who are perhaps encouraging them, or there is this increasing sense that maybe it's a really good idea, and maybe actually taking the leap and going to Syria will make them the hero that they want to be. And I think it's a very effective video, and I urge you to watch it to kind of see how one of these things can look. But of course, a video like that isn't going to have the same effect on an English, an Arab supporter of Islamic State as it does on an English one, because there are a lot of English, British motifs in there and references to life in Britain. There is no, even within this one small, relatively small target audience, there's no one video, no one narrative that can be used. So I think that we really need to go at it in a more granular manner and look at a variety of different narratives. Recognize that we're not just looking at one target audience, but that there's a very broad spectrum of people that we need to be reaching out to. And then thinking very carefully about what kind of things appeal to them, what kind of things will resonate and what kind of things won't. If we do that, then I think that from a structural point of view, we'll be better able to put together something that actually means something to the people that we're trying to reach out to.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show, Charlie. And for our listeners, the paper is The Virtual Caliphate, Understanding Islamic State's Propaganda Strategy. And I highly recommend anyone that's interested in this topic to read it. There are some great images, graphs, all kinds of great information in it. It's a very good read, and thank you for putting in all the amazing work to write this piece of fantastic research, Charlie.
Thank you very much, and thanks for
Thank
having me on
you.
the show.